Andy, how are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I got a little bit of sore throat today, so you're probably glad that I'm not actually right next to you could give you my germs. But I'm tell you what, I'm keeping really busy because we seem to be the victims of making a very well-received album. Everybody's saying nice things and wants to talk to us, which is a nice problem to have.
If you look at this kind of second stint that the band has had, and it's now, I think it's longer than the first stint, right? So how do you
Correct.
kind of compare the two then? Because there seems to be somewhat of an increased interest, even though how successful you were in the 80s, there seems this new appreciation almost for the music of OMD and the continued music that you bring out. So how do you perceive those two stints of the band?
You're right, we have been reformed longer than we were formed in the first place. I think that there's a lot of contributing facts. I think after we got into the new millennium, things changed in the world. We went into the postmodern era where there was nothing culturally new anymore. So there was nothing completely out of date, and all popular culture, not just music, but all popular culture started eating its own history. So people started to ask us, say, oh, what you did was iconic in its genre. Some of your songs are timeless already. Would you like to play again? So we've reformed to play again in 2007. After a couple of years, we were like, okay, now, are we just a tribute band to ourselves? Is that all we're going to do? Just play the old songs over and over and over again? So we dared to do the stupid, crazy thing and try to write some new songs. And we are now come up to our fourth new album. And I think we did the right thing because one thing is, these days we don't have a record company saying you got to have an album out for Christmas, you got to do this, you got to do it. When it's ready, it's ready. Nobody tells us. So, we have time to edit and get right and get it right. And I think obviously the new one's just coming out, but the four albums we've made have kind of contemporized us. We're not just a retro band. We're actually still making new records that people really like. And they're like, it sounds as full of energy as you did when you're like 40 years ago. How are you doing it? So, yeah, I think making the new records has been part of keeping the whole band kind of in people's heads.
The creative process then, because you mentioned and in an interview with us a couple of years earlier, you also mentioned the early days of the band, you kind of, because of the contract that you signed, you had to bring out albums to keep the band going. And now you have all this time, and especially with the lockdown and everything that happened there, you have all this time to work on music. How do you appreciate that time? What is your approach to songwriting? Because I can imagine you can also start to overthink a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, it is essential. I think we prefer having time. There were times, particularly towards the late 80s, in that, and obviously I said it last time I was interviewed. We signed a contract when we were 19 years old that gave us very, very low royalties, and all the costs came out of our royalties. Now, by contrast, Depeche Mode, who were on Mute, had a 50-50 deal. After the costs, they split the profit with the label. So they were making millions, and we were losing money, even though we were selling millions. And it wasn't because we were buying castles and yachts, it was. So yeah, we were pushed and pushed and pushed because we had no money, and that was to the detriment of the quality of the music. Now we can take the time. The important thing is you don't kind of you need to be a great editor. And the technology now, you can have hundreds and hundreds of tracks and lots of different sounds, and you have to be ruthless. You have to have a vision and stick to it, because otherwise it just gets fat. And I go to my library and go, okay, bass drum. 40 years ago, it was like there was only two bass drums. It was a live one or the one from the Roland drum machine. Now it's like bass drum library, right? 2,852 bass drums. Which ones shall I use? You can get lost.
Yeah, that's what I can imagine, especially the way you've always incorporated technology into the music and try to evolve that as well. Is that tricky to figure out that balance, as you mentioned, to not go in too deep of an electronic world, but also keep your pop sensibilities and You're trying to make the best song you can possibly can.
I think the thing is that what we stick to is the way we've always worked, which is we actually experiment. I mean, we have an amazing ability to put melodies and vocals that people can sing along with on the top, but they're always the last thing that goes on.
Okay.
What we work on is a crazy idea, a weird sound, a new synthesizer that's got some crazy sounds in it. And we start experimenting and just having fun, and we see where it goes. And I think that is, we still work exactly the same way. The only difference now is that we have a little bit more time. I mean, it's also, we need it because it's harder. You know, when you've done over 200 different pieces of music and released them, you write something and you go, no, I've done that before. No, that sounds like, no, that's the same chords to the, it's like you gotta try a little bit harder to do something new.
But I find that interesting because do you find yourself at moments or at times wanting to have changed kind of certain little things you did in the past? Or because I
Oh,
imagine
yeah.
I remember you, I think you were not the fondest of Souvenir, and so do you have those moments when you hear those songs again that you think, oh, I should have done this different?
You know, well, first of all, you mellow with age. You know,
Fair
we were
enough.
very spiky and pretentious when we were young. Certainly I was. I can remember, you know, when you've written a song and recorded it and mixed it, you're so close to it, it's almost impossible to be objective. It takes several months for you to step away from it, not listen to it, and then you start to listen to it objectively again. You go, oh, okay, no, it works now. I'm not listening to that go, oh, the hi-hat's too loud, or I got the vocal wrong, or, you know, I'm not picking holes in little details. I'm looking at the big picture and it works. So yeah, it's I have mellowed. I did think Souvenir was cheesy, and but Paul also thought Enola Gay was cheesy, so there you go, you know.
But
We had to adopt each other's babies.
and then this goes into, because this is something that you mentioned as well, that the two of you quite separate are different people, and then separate from each other you make quite different music. Now when Bauer Staircase, or when a lot of those ideas were worked on, we were living in a world where you couldn't have that contact and it was all electronic. So how did that affect kind of the creative process for Bauhaus Staircase?
We were unable to be in the same room. Yeah, we couldn't write together. And also, I like to write in my room. This is my programming room I'm talking to you now. I like to write in this room because the honesty of things, I am the control freak. I am the type A person. Paul is more mellow. Paul has life outside of OMD. I mean, he just became a dad. He's got a 2.5-year-old baby again now. So, you know,
Right.
he has some other priorities. He has a real life. I'm just got blinkers on like this. So I keep the stuff in my computer so I know it will get worked on. Because if I leave it with Paul, it'll get left for months. I want to have it so that if I'm in the mood, I can work on it. But yeah, COVID, I don't feel sorry for him because he got locked down in the south of France. Not a bad place
Not
to be
the
stuck.
worst place you can be.
So you know, so yeah, we were having to send things through the internet, but we have identical twin computer systems so that he can send me the complete track and I have all the plugins, all the synthesizers, everything, and it just comes up exactly how he had it, and I can do the same for him.
This passion, or I don't know if I can call it an obsession with music that you have, as you mentioned. What do you attribute that to? And is that something that's always been with you, kind of that drive to make things, to put things out, to kind of and to yeah, not to. I think it's a good segue into Verushka, because it's that kind of idea of going for something and then not just waiting for things to happen, but just going for something.
Thank you. I mean, I think, you know, I just have, even now at 64, I think I've got a lot of energy. I get passionate. I get excited. I even get angry. You know, there's a couple of angry songs on the record as
Sure.
well. But I think if you don't do things with energy, then, well, you shouldn't do them. Simply, you just shouldn't do them, you know? Don't make a record because you want to go on tour, but you've got nothing left to say, and you just want a new logo on the tour t-shirt. You know, Listen, we can all name bands who, you know, go into the
Sure.
studio and they go, "Have you got any ideas? No. Have you got no? Well, oh fuck it. Let's just jam for a couple of weeks and see what happens." You know, and they shouldn't make records. They should stay away because they're just using their fans' love to kind of take advantage of them. So we promised we wouldn't do that. You know what, Robin, the being in Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark is quite cool now. People say nice things about us. So the last thing we want to do is make a really fucking shit album after 45 years. Everybody goes,
Sure.
"Well, they used to be cool, but they've really lost it now." And if they play any of those tracks on stage, I'm going to the toilet.
But that's an interesting dynamic because obviously, when you're making the music that you've made in the past, you're not conscious of it. But are you aware now of kind of the impact that you had on the on music and kind of the legacy that you've left? And are you more conscious of that as you make new music?
We have heard people talk about the influence we've had on them. Some it's kind of hard to believe, actually, but yeah, it's flattering. You know, when people say, you know, "Oh, you're influential, you're iconic," you say, "Well, I'll take that." You know, because 45 years ago when we started, you know, a lot of the journalists, a lot of the music press, a lot of radio and TV, they didn't want to know about us. What you're doing, that's not music. It's not real music. That's not manly. It's not authentic. Fucking synthesizer shit. What are you doing that for? You're copying Kraftwerk and their shit too. You know, it was.
Yeah, I heard you say that's the reason why it was always a duo because you and Paul couldn't find anyone to play with.
Yeah, initially, when we were teenagers, it was just me and him because everybody else was into like Genesis and the Eagles and Pink Floyd, you know?
But does that kind of, especially when you start a new album, and you even said that this might very well be the last album that you make, it does that create a certain, I don't want to say pressure because you don't have any, I think, external goals in that sense, but you want it to be good, right? To end with a bang. So how does that mental process go into the songs and kind of making them perfect the way you like them?
It's just simple. You just keep working, and if the song is good, you keep sculpting it and honing it and adding and chipping bits out and changing it till hopefully one day you walk in and you play it and you go, "There's nothing I need to change. That is saying everything I wanted to say." Sometimes you get to that place quite quickly. Other times it takes, frankly, fucking years. You know? This album was ready when it was ready. You know, we didn't tell anybody until we knew we had a good collection of songs. It was there's no theme. It's not a concept album. It's just a case of just, you know, basically when we had enough good songs, we decided it was ready to mix and go. And because we'd taken the time, and because, you know, the great thing with your computer is your demo becomes your final master, becomes the one you mix. That every time you go to your computer and you fire it up, you know, yesterday you could have been writing something and you thought you were in the moment and you were buzzing, you thought it was great. Today you come back and you go, "What the hell was I thinking yesterday? That's not working. No, it's not talking to me. God damn. Okay, well, put it in the file marked, you know, something in there, but not good enough, and I'll come back to it maybe." But no, sometimes you come back to something and you go, "Oh, okay, yeah, it's talking to me. It's still saying exactly what I wanted to say back to me." And that's when you think, "Yeah, that one's on the album. That one's going to work."
But you do raise an interesting point because I hear from a lot of musicians, some of their favorite songs are the ones that kind of fall out immediately and that those end up being the biggest songs. What is your experience with this? Were some of the kind of the hits that you wrote, were they written quickly or did it take a long time to get them right? What is your approach on this?
In the 80s, we never had much time to take too
Fair
long
enough.
to,
Fair
you know,
enough.
but you know, yeah, I mean, we worked on Enola Gay for a while. I mean, we actually recorded Enola Gay in the spring of 1980 for a film called Erg the Music War. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but it was lots and lots of bands from 1980, many of them before they were really famous were filmed. And it was before Enola Gay had the drum machine on it. I
Okay.
think I changed some of the lyrics. So, you know, that took a few months. Maid of Orléans, which of course was a massive, massive song
Sure.
in Holland. We weren't even going to record that for the Architectural Morality album. That's why there are two Joan of Arcs, because I thought the first one wasn't working. And recently, Paul found the demo, and I listened to it, and it wasn't working. It sounds shit, but it had the melody. And I remember Malcolm, our drummer, just said, "Why don't we record that? Let me play drums on it. I'll make it a hit." And he did, and he did. So, you know, it was yeah. So, some things take a little longer. I mean, there's Kleptocracy on this album. I've had the melody for about 6 years. I only got the
Okay.
lyrics a couple of years ago. You know, so you just never know. You never know.
Let's delve into Kleptocracy then, because when did the lyrics come to you? Was it something specific you saw in the news, or was it more of a general idea about how society was kind of operating at the time?
I've been angry for quite some time. I mean, I do believe in democracy. I think as a way for humans to get along with each other and compromise and find ways to have different opinions but try to work together, it's the best idea. But it feels recently like our democracy is being stolen by lying narcissist politicians who don't care about other people. They literally are just narcissists, and they sell their countries down the river. You know, I
Right.
mean, Boris Johnson absolutely fucked Britain. It'll take us years before we recover from the damage he's done to us with Brexit. Trump, terrifying. Hope to God he doesn't get re-elected. Putin, thank you very much for another war in Europe in my lifetime. I didn't think there'd be one. And Saudi Arabia, you know. When Khashoggi went into the embassy and came back out a week later in different bags, everybody went, "Oh, shocking, terrible! Oh, Saudi Arabia! Oh, dear, dear, dear!" And then after 6 months, it's like, right, has everybody forgotten? Yeah. How many airplanes do you want to buy this year? How many guns can we sell you? You know, it's just give us some oil.
It's
So
yeah,
I was angry. Pardon?
the money thing that I heard you see football players being bought up by Saudi Arabia money. I think the whole golf tour is taken over by Saudi money. So it's such a strange time in that respect. When you write about these things, because you've mentioned before in earlier pieces of music, you weren't that political. What was that, a confidence thing? Was that just a thing that you didn't want to be too political? And why do you feel like it's more appropriate now?
We have been political, but this time around it just seemed to come out more openly. I mean, Enola Gay is political,
Sure,
effectively. It's
sure.
discussing the, you know, the moral question of dropping an atom bomb. Dazzleship's album is all about the Cold War. That was political, you know. I mean, that was written before the end of the Cold. Well, the Cold War hasn't ended. Mr. Putin started it up
Started
again.
again.
So you know that I've. The whole thing about Orchestral Illusion in the Dark is just the mantra is write about something that you're interested in, do it in an interesting way, and then people will hopefully be interested to hear it. You know, don't just write songs that are like, "Oh, baby, I love you, but you've left me," blah, 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 cliche, cliche, stereotype, boring, boring, you know.
I have to listen to a lot of those albums for this line of job.
I feel for you. You have my sympathy.
That's interesting then, because you mentioned Bauhaus Staircase isn't you don't consider it to be a concept album, but this notion of the Bauhaus kind of art movement, and when did that kind of start to influence the creative process?
Okay. Once I got over wanting to be an archaeologist, when I was about 12, I got interested in art. And in fact, I should have gone and done a fine art degree, but I took a gap year and we started the band, and I never went to university to do art. So art has always been influential on me. And of course, Bauhaus was an art school in Germany from 1919 to 33. And it was a practical art application. It was functional. It wasn't just esoteric kind of art for art's sake. And still the Nazis closed it down in 33 because totalitarian regimes are frightened of art. They don't understand it. They can't control it, or they try to, but they can't. And it can criticize them. And sometimes it can criticize them and they're too stupid to even know they're being criticized. So we had no access to art other than online for 3 years during COVID. And we missed it. And yet, even then, governments, democratic governments, tend to think, well, times are hard. Let's not spend any money on art. That's a luxury. We don't need it. I mean, there was posters in England that had a girl going, today she's a ballet dancer, but next year she could be an accountant. And it's like, oh, so all creative things are just a waste of fucking time. Thank you so much. Well, they're not. You need a roof over your head. You need some food in your stomach, but you also need to feed your soul. And without creativity in the world, it's a very, very gray, empty place. So Bauhaus Staircase is not a history lesson. It's a continuing call to the power of art and passion to enrich our lives.
And that same discussion was kind of active here, where certain artists weren't even paid to perform. They were told, well, you're getting exposure, so we're not going to pay you. And so the value of art, as you say, kind of, do you think that's shifting? Because we do live in this technological era where everything's so quick, and every like we have social media where things are only 10 seconds or whatever, and it just goes and goes and goes. Do you think the appreciation or the value of art, do you think that's in a good place, or how do you see that?
I think, I mean, there are people who appreciate it. There are sadly still people who don't feel that it talks to them. And they don't think they can go to an art gallery, and but I think, I mean, on a broader terms, in terms of music, since music went digital, people's perception of it has changed. I mean, amazingly, vinyl is still alive and is growing, but most people still consume their music digitally, and it's something they click on their laptop or their phone. It's a file. It's an icon. They can copy it. They can send it. They can put it in the bin. And I think since consuming music stopped being mostly a physical product, I think a lot of people don't think of it as having a monetary value. It's not worth paying money for. You can have it for free, so it's not got the same value as it used to have. And I think that has changed the perception. But I mean, people still go to the concerts, and it's interesting, People don't want to pay 99 cents to download a song or buy a CD, but they'll go and pay 100 euros to go to a gig.
Their festival ticket prices
Oh,
are
yeah.
ridiculous,
So
and they're always sold out.
they seem to treasure the experience more than the music itself. Well, yeah. Hey, listen, things change, Things change. You have to get used to it.
I have one last question. One song that really stuck out to me was "Evolution of Species," and I heard that this was partly made with the help of Google Translate. Now, for you, trying to use voices that are not your own, how do you kind of figure that out? How do you use your own voice as a kind of placeholder, and then figure out how to do it? Or
Completely the opposite. It's a work tool for me. I discovered this several years ago, and when I was working songs up, trying ideas out, it was a little kind of placeholder for, I didn't have to think of the melody, but I could come up with some words that I could hang some ideas on. And so, yeah, you'd write it in, you choose who's going to say it, which man, which woman, which language, and you just put them in a. I started like that on Anthropocene, but then once it started growing, it became obvious that I needed to sing on it. But I think, to be honest, it's hard enough thinking how to sing on Anthropocene. How you sing a melody about evolutionary theory, I mean, not even I think, could do that. And I sing about some weird shit. But no, it's just a case of it was all there. I tried different languages, and I just thought, this is working. This I don't need to sing on it. And I like all the different, because it's about humans. I mean, Anthropocene and Evolution of Species are kind of like buddies. You know, they're dealing with the same
Sure.
thing about human evolution. And it seemed very relevant to me when we were in a pandemic. And I mean, 20 million people died. If it had been
Right.
the Black Death, if it had been the Black Death, 50% of the world population would have died. And that really would have changed things. So, you know, you ask yourself questions about your place in the world and how long you're going to be here for. And it's so yeah, these are the things that I write songs about. And sometimes I use my own voice, and sometimes I use text to spell, and I hope the translations are correct.
One last thought then, because is it 100% that this will be the last album? And if so, do you see yourself continuing making music without releasing it?
If we make music and we think it's really good and it's worth hearing, it will be released. Whether it will be a whole album, I don't know. I don't think I can sit in this room day after day after day
Right.
after day after day towards my late 60s. You know, I haven't had a hard life. I haven't been working down a coal mine or a farmer who works 16 hours a day, you know. But I'm mid 60s. I've been doing this for 45 years. I would like to, as we say in England, I would like to take time to smell the roses. So, you know, we're excited about this new album. If it is the last one, we think it's a great way to go, because then it's like, you know, it would be, without jinxing us, it's like, die when you're 27, then you can't fuck up your career. You know, it's like, if this is the last one, it's a good place to say goodbye. People will then still say, they made good songs from Electricity to Bauhaus Staircase. Wow. I think I'm cool with that.
I think that's a beautiful note to end on. So, Andy, may I thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Robin. Nice to talk to you, and all the very best.